and I welcome you cordially to my podcast, Musik Leben. This is a German podcast I started in 2018, but as I have communicated already, I present now one English episode each month. So if you also want to support me and my work, please subscribe or please recommend this podcast to your friends and colleagues. I have studied classical voice and singing, and I love to sing contemporary and experimental music. And you find a lot about me on my website www.irenekurka.de. I will put this in the show notes for you. You can also subscribe to my monthly newsletter on my website. And in this podcast, I talk about topics all around contemporary and experimental music. I share with you the behind the scenes, the inside knowledge, and what is most important to me, I bring you, or hopefully I bring you, the human beings out of the new music world closer. I'm really thankful for all your feedbacks and emails, and I can't say this enough because I know it's a thing to really take time and say, okay, I like her podcast, but now I'm taking the time to write her, or now I take the time to whatever, give 5 stars on Apple or write a review or whatever. And so I'm really thankful for that. I'm also thankful for all the listeners, I must now say, throughout the world, because this podcast is appearing in charts in very interesting countries throughout the world. So wherever you are, this is a big hi and hug to you, and thank you so much for listening to this podcast, supporting my work, and also make the new music world more visible also for the others. I'm cooperating with the NMZ, Neue Musikzeitung, and in today's interview, I'm talking with Max Riefer. Max Riefer is a percussion player. He also has the new music ensemble at the Musikhochschule Lübeck in Germany at the SEE. Very gorgeous town. He's a professor there. And despite the fact that he's an amazing percussion player, and we talk about also this instrument, he has been working and also living in Southeast Asia a lot. And we are talking about the music scene there. And that is so, so exciting. I'm so happy that I can present this music to you, the scene over there, and there will be more interviews coming up about this area because, yeah, we both, Max and me, have the feeling that we should know more about what's going on there. So this is the opportunity to figure out what's going on in Southeast Asia. And you get to know Max Riefer. So please enjoy the interview with Max. Hello, Max. Hello, Max Riefer. I cordially welcome you into my podcast, Neue Musik Leben.
Thank you very much, Irene. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Let's get started with the question. How did you find your way into new and experimental music?
Yeah, I mean, considering that I'm a percussionist, I think, we can't avoid that sooner or later. But actually, I was very lucky to have a teacher, my very first percussion teacher in the city's music school where I grew up in, St. Wendel in Saarland. Norbert Scherer, he played new experimental contemporary music. And I remember a concert that he played together with Achim Seiler from Schlagquartett Köln. And they played Steve Reich clapping music, and they played some parts from Stockhausen Tierkreis, and the rest I don't remember, but I do remember that I thought this music was somewhat appealing. So I wanted to know more about this. I was very lucky to have a teacher who was very supportive of that. And I played in the National Youth Orchestra for sure. We played some premieres there, Peter Rusitschka and others, Bernd Franke. And then also sort of it was a coincidence that I found my first a new music ensemble for piano and percussion with pianist Sebastian Volz. And I was barely 17 at the time or so, but we were asked to play a concert together. We didn't know each other. And then we had to look at stuff like repertoire for piano and percussion. And I was very sure I don't want to do some Baroque transcriptions or so. At that time, it didn't make any sense for me, and still today it doesn't. So yeah, so I got into this new music world, and then I started studying with Bernhard Wolff in Freiburg. And of course, then you are exposed to a lot of beautiful new music. I think there's this short story that I can tell in the very first meeting, my very, very first meeting before my first semester with Bernhard Wolff and the studio. He was talking about plans for the next semester, and he talked about a concert to China, and I listened, but it didn't even came to my mind that I would go on that tour. And suddenly he gave me a part score, and I looked at it, and it said, Yannis Xenakis, Persephassa. So I knew that at that time, Yannis Xenakis is that dude who wrote Rebond. That was all I knew about him. And so I asked Bernhard Wolff, oh, what is this? And he said, didn't you listen? That's for the China tour. And that was my summer before the first semester practicing Yannis Xenakis. But so these were the some of the milestones of me getting into new music.
So this was then already your first tour to Asia?
That was my first trip on my very first day of studies. Yeah.
That's really amazing. And also that you got to play a piece by Xenakis. I mean, he's like, I guess, the hero for percussion.
Definitely one of the very, very, very grand, important people. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so then you went to Southeast Asia to, how was that for you? Are you getting, touch base with such a different country than Europe?
Yeah. So when I moved there in 2015, I was not a complete stranger to the region. I think that's very important to keep in mind. The very first concert tour to Southeast Asia was in 2006, also with the percussion ensemble of the Musikhochschule in Freiburg, Music University. And then let's say the very influential tour was in 2011, going to Manila with Ensemble Celici, and that was organized by composer Dieter Mack. And Dieter Mack, some of you might know, he is also not a stranger to the region as well. He's very experienced. So through him and through this tour, I got to know some of the very important, very influential composers like Jonas Baez, Kyung Chong, Ikaho, Iwan Gunawan. And from then on, I got invitations to do projects in Southeast Asia, mostly in Singapore and Malaysia. So that was in these 4 years between 11 and 15. So I remember that at one point, people ask me, hey, you're in the region so often, could you consider staying here for longer? And I could. So I got this job offer in 2015 and decided, I just go, I'll try for a year and then we see what happens. Well, it turned out to be a bit longer than a year, yeah. So how was that? It would be very, very superficial to say it was fantastic, but that's what it was. I got to know this very, very lively music scene, new music scene. And of course, it is different than in Europe, fore and foremost in terms of quantity. I mean, there are not as many players, as many composers, as many practitioners as a whole. But what we can tell is that the scene or scenes happen in the urban centers in Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, Jakarta, Bangkok, Bangkok, Kuala Lumpur, Singapore, Manila, Jakarta, Hanoi partly, Yogyakarta. And there are composers usually tied to institutions, not always, but usually, that are very, very knowledgeable, very curious, very experiment happy. And I thought this was such a unique and inspiring way of working. So in terms of work, my move to Southeast Asia was extremely enriching and maybe in a way, after my studies, the most influential time for my music career. Yeah, well, personally, it was also fantastic to live there, but I think that's not part of this podcast.
I remember, I think a few times at a festival in Trier, maybe you know that too, opening, mm-hmm. which Bernd Bleffert and mm-hmm. Thomas Rath organized. And they often also invite an artist from a foreign country. And I remember, I think it was a Korean percussion player, and he had just this one thing where he played on the sides. I don't know what the name is.
There's a
And he
jungle,
did it in
probably,
a,
yeah.
probably, and he did it in a, at an amazing speed. I was just mind blowing him working this instrument. And it was so fascinating for me that that was all he played. It was just this drum, but he played it to a super, super, super perfection. And I actually sat there with a percussion player, and he was also very amazed, but he said, "Well, I can play so many different drums really well, but I probably could not do what he did." And so I'm now curious, how is it there, or is it still like that with percussion, or does it depend if it is more traditional or more contemporary? I mean, you also play many percussion
Yeah, I do.
instruments, and what's going on there in all those nice places you just mentioned?
That also depends a little bit where you are. I think when, for example, when we look at Indonesia, there's still this very, very strong, I mean, gamelan tradition, which is probably the most known. There are other modes of performance as well, of course. And so what we should be aware of is that contemporary and traditional are not two opposite poles. What we find a lot, I was in Bali recently, and there is absolutely breathtaking, and you said mind-blowing. There are performers who come from this very rich gamelan tradition, their respective traditions. There are many, of course, but they experiment with it. And surely sometimes we can tell, oh, this sounds probably new if they have some very interesting tunings, since this is a thing now that they use different tunings than they used to be 100 years ago, and so on. They invent their own tunings. So maybe for someone who is a bit more experienced in gamelan listening, they would tell, yes, that is obviously something new. But I think if you don't have this experience, you sometimes could not even tell if that's new, it's that old, is it traditional, is it experimental? So that's one thing we always have to be aware of. How is it there? Yes, exactly that. You have a lot of masters that are super experts on their instrument, whatever they do. It is probably a bit less, at least how I know it, than in Korea and Japan, where really these grandmasters have usually one focus instrument. What I experienced in Southeast Asia is that people come from their mode of production, mode of practice, but they play a couple of instruments, especially those who lead ensembles. I mean, I think that's very clear that they have to do this. But yeah, these so-called traditional modes of practice, I'd like to call them also local modes of practice, they play still an important role in at the university where I used to teach at UITM. We had a department for what would be translated as traditional percussion, and I had a colleague from the East Coast of Malaysia. He's absolutely fabulous. Yeah, so this still plays a role, absolutely.
And then I also can hear that the traditional music and whatever we call new or contemporary is much closer than maybe here in Germany.
Absolutely, because it is still seen where you come from. And of course, sure, you have, no matter where you go in Southeast Asia, you sure have people who are very busy with protecting whatever they think is a very long tradition. So I don't want to say that these people don't know. They sure know, but we have to be aware that, music is always moving. But the vast majority of people who I met, they were very open, very interested, and extremely creative. With some people, like in Bali, there are these two guys. They were Alit and Iwayan Sudirana. They have their gamelan ensembles, and for them, it's actually very natural to explore new things. And yeah, so yeah. That's it. Yeah.
And would you say the music they know whatever their new music is it do they actually write it up, or is a lot of it also improvised, or what's the balance between the two?
Yeah, I think again, like it is a bit difficult now to give a very clear definition for the whole region, as we have to keep in mind Southeast Asia is quite a big region. But of course, traditionally, music is orally taught, means no notation. But for those who have come from this traditional background, yes, they very often also write down music, like, you know, I mentioned the two Balinese before, but also Iwan Guna, one from Bandung. So you can tell they write it down. But also what we have to see that in Southeast Asia, you also have these composers that have this knowledge of their local traditions, but they also compose in a way what we would describe as contemporary music or new music or experimental music as well.
And so, and they also like invite not just people like you, but also then European contemporary music. Are they curious to listen to it?
Absolutely, absolutely. So what I mentioned before, now let me maybe give you a little historical overview. Sorry for that. We have to keep in mind that we can trace back pretty much when this, what we call contemporary music with like European roots, has started being influential in the region. So that was first in the Philippines through a gentleman called José Maceda, who studied in France and worked in France. He brought these thoughts that, you know, these ideas back to the Philippines. And the same in Indonesia with Slamet Abdul Syukur just a few years later. So Maceda was in the early 60s and Slamet Abdul Syukur in the beginning of the 70s, 19, obviously. And they went to Paris and later also partly to the US, also to Köln at that time. And they learned, they saw what was going on. And being smart people as they were, they thought, how can I incorporate what I learned here in Europe with the things that I find at home? And not in a way, how can I just mix it, but really in a smart way, what does that even mean? This music that is played and composed in Europe at that time, what does this mean for Indonesia, for the Philippines later than with other people in Malaysia? And so they had their music with these different influences, and they passed it on to students. And some of these students also went abroad, came back, Europe, Northern America, sometimes East Asia. And then the same processes kept going. And then, you know, the region is, of course, not something where you can't get out. So also, even if people didn't study, they went out on tours, others came in. So over the course of the last 50, 60 years, there has been this process of cultural contact, of musical contact, that led to a music that is highly individual by each composer. So in that sense, it's not that much different than it is in Europe. What is different, of course, is that some of these composers still think about what are my roots? What is this music that I grew up in? Maybe some of them, maybe not at all. If you grew up in Kuala Lumpur, you might not get in touch with some, not necessarily get in touch with some traditional music from the East Coast of Malaysia, because it might not really happen around you, depending on where you live. But there are these composers who still sort of are in between this, and therefore it's a bit difficult to give this music labels. But I think what is so interesting is exactly this discourse. How do we deal with this formerly called European, now with these local modes of performance?
Thank you very much for this overview and when it all got started. The other thing I'm often thinking about, and I will explain it. For one thing, I also got into medieval music, and then I realized that over the whole world, for a really long time, all the music was modal. And if you looked like at the raga or Indian music throughput, it's still modal and it's a oral tradition, and probably they still sing it like they sing it whatever the last 1,000 years or longer. And in Europe, something else happened. We got the printing that we could print books and scores with the early whatever news. Mm-hmm. And so we started printing, and then we started to produce an artificial music that has not just one voice, but more voices, more mm-hmm. polyphonic. And in the other areas, there still might be also more melodies or more harmonies, but it was, I guess, it kept in the improvised sense. And I also realized when I look at Indian music that they discovered much more the space between the notes, and we just ignored that a little until maybe contemporary music with microtones and whatever stuck then to or whatever well-tempered tuning and so on. But then in Europe, we started fixing it, and the fixing has the advantage, okay, later on people can look it up and maybe reproduce it. But you also lose things through the oral tradition. And then we had those epochs, areas, those things in Europe, like, okay, Renaissance music, Baroque, classical, romantic, and whatever, contemporary music now, and whatever else is going on. And so I wonder how it is over there with the writing or fixing. Did it also change things, or is the tradition then still alive, like this mm-hmm. oral tradition? Because it's I feel ambivalent, because mm-hmm. I'm thankful for the scores I have, whatever, from Hildegard von Bingen. But I also am, when I do like raga or so, I'm jealous that they have this direct approach through this mm-hmm. long, long oral tradition.
Yeah, I think it exists both. I'm talking about Southeast Asia. I remember I was once invited to a performing arts festival in East Java, in the mountains. And when I say really in the mountains, I really mean up in the hills. Surrounded by forest, and the festival just got the village got a paved road, I think the year 2 years before, just because of this festival that's organized by a friend of mine. And in the Lhasa, we had all these performing arts, dancers, music, and so on. It was fantastic. And then the last night, there was a gamelan group from the village or from the neighboring village playing, and they played a Wayankulit performance, this shadow puppet theater, for about 6 hours, which is actually breathtaking. And of course, they learn it in you know, through oral tradition. There's no written down things. Also, I talked about my colleague at UITM, Kamrul Hussein, who also teaches through oral tradition. So these things are still relevant and still exist. But now we, of course, have to look at the type of music we play. So if we play pieces, I mentioned a couple of names before, Jonas Beis, for example, or Tony Brabovo, Michael Asmara, like good friends of mine. Learning their music or teaching their music orally is probably pretty difficult, because it is music that would rather resemble what we would consider as European contemporary music. So I think when we can just do this little thought experiment, imagine you would need to learn a Marteau sans maître, but orally, somebody would teach you this orally. It would probably be a very cool experiment. It would take a lot of time, and it would need also the player to be open for this, the players to be open for this. So I think this really is a question of which mode of production you are in at the moment.
When you say this, it reminds me of something that is also an interesting thought now. I think like in the 60s, 70s, also 90s, 60s, 70s, and maybe even later, there have been singers, opera singers, where I know I'm not going to mention names, but I knew people who coached them and did practice the parts with them. And there were singers who sang all over the world, big names, and they were not like in that way musically trained, like that they could read the score. So they actually really had this piano player who would teach them as long that they knew the part and they could sing them big opera houses.
Yeah, why not? Why not?
Just different way. And I mean, nothing is wrong with that. I mean, obviously they did a great job, and if you don't know, nobody would question their performance.
Yeah, no, and why should it be? I think we can maybe break this down a little bit to say, well, if we practice, prepare pieces for whatever, solo pieces, ensemble stuff, I think the way how we approach this, how we learn this, is totally up to us. It should, we hope things to be good in rehearsals, latest on stage. But I think how you get there, that's a very individual thing.
And when you're in Southeast Asia and there are those great concerts at mountains or wherever, do they have an audience? Are they more curious than the people here? Is it packed? Is it full?
Well, that's a good question. There is audience, of course, there is. So this thing on the mountain, this festival in Belém, that is, well, I want to say an exception, and maybe not, because you do have music festivals, music performance in many, many villages all over, especially in Java and Bali. Not only. Yes, you have audience, and this specific festival I talked about, you had the villagers who came because there was something going on. And of course, for some of them, these contemporary performances might have been new, maybe a bit odd. That's okay, but they come and listen. And some then told me, yeah, for them the highlight is this shadow puppet theater, but they also listened and watched the other concert. So that was in the village. I have to say, when I did or when I was part of this opera production Gandhari by Tony Bravo in 2019, we had two performances, and both, I don't know if the hall was sold out, but I remember we had over 1,200 people in one performance. So let's say 2,000, almost 2,500 people watched this opera, and it's a contemporary music opera. So yes, you can find the audience also in Kuala Lumpur. When I still play concerts, also with former students and so on, we do get a few hundred people in the audience. I think one thing is very important to mention also, this happens in the urban centers. I talk about Java a lot, but I think Java and Bali are a bit exceptions themselves for these kind of concerts. You have also concerts in Manila and a lot of music going on in the Philippines, but this contemporary music, that's what we perceive as contemporary or new music, experimental music, this does usually happen again in the big cities.
That sounds really amazing. And you already mentioned a few names, and I can already let the listeners know that I will also talk to some of them.
Great.
And we can discover this region more, because I'm also very curious, and I'm so thankful that you can, share this experience with us. And another thing I'm curious is how does funding work there? How do they do that, or how is it different to Europe?
I think what is the same in Europe, that it's difficult to get funding. So the most of the projects I'm involved in are somewhat tied to an academic institution. I think this is something that can be said for most of the projects. And then there is funding for that. We have our Like I teach in Lübeck at the Musikhochschule, and one of our partner schools is the Princess Galaya Wardana Institute of Music in Bangkok. Pardon my Thai, that's obviously not very good. They just allocate money for contemporary music projects, for symposia, where it's not just about playing new works, but it's even more interesting. And I think this is something we have to keep in mind when we talk about new music in general, that there are also a lot of questions of modes of performance, like in terms of where do we play this music, where does it happen, who do we play it for, and then of course, in the Southeast Asian context, these things might mean something else as well. So there is money allocated simply because in these institutions, also YST Conservatory in Singapore, Manila, UP, I might not mention everyone, but we can maybe put this later on in the show notes. Because there is this understanding that it's not just about supporting a new work being performed, but it's this very important in-depth discourse of what this music in our time mean. And also then, of course, in this institution, what does music education in our time mean? What does it need to provide? What do we expect? How do we want to influence that? The other projects that are not tied to an institution, or at least to an academic institution, these are, it's difficult to find funding. We have to, or we shouldn't say that there is no money. There is sure money. When we think of countries like, especially Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, there is money. It's just the question is how you get that money. There are foundations, and of course you can get a little bit here and there, but I'd say it is in a way more or less as difficult as getting funding in Europe.
Well, thank you so much for getting us into this. And I know we probably touched the first layer, and there's so much more we could talk about and discover, and let's see how the journey goes or who I will talk to.
Yes.
And I would now talk more about you and as your work. And I'm always curious, when you work with composers, what are the qualities you most appreciate in them?
That's a very good question. I think a very important aspect, I don't know if that's the most important, but a very important aspect for me is that when a composer decides to work with me, that they understand that I am also an artist. So I want to do justice to the piece. Of course, I want to play what's written, and put it in a very, very simple term. But I realized more and more, I really appreciate when a composer says, hey, this is different from what I imagined, but it seems to work for you. It sounds good. Please do that. So that is one of the things that are very important to me. And then also, I like composers who have this own reflection of cultural context. I mean, this has a little bit to do with my work in the last couple of years. But I think I appreciate this very much when you have people who pose exactly these questions: where am I from? Does this matter to my music? I think it's totally fine if I just recently again had a talk with Joey Tan from Singapore, who is studying in Freiburg at the moment, who she wrote a piece for me, a solo piece, and she used bottles, ceramic pots, a wooden board, and a sun gong. And she said, I want to use these materials because I want to erase every acoustic connection to Southeast Asia. I think that's actually a very valid point. But that already shows me that she did these reflections on what everything she learned means to her art. These are maybe the two aspects that I could mention on top of my head. Other than that, actually, I'm very open. If somebody writes a piece for me, I will perform it, because I think whoever writes a piece of music for me, that is such a big honor. And also, I think through working with composers, I learn so much more. I enhance my knowledge, widen my my scope. So therefore, I want to be also very open and flexible when I work with composers.
I'm always amazed when I work with you percussionists or see you, and you have all this stuff, all those toys, and then you're obviously most of the times the first who gets there to set everything up, and
yes,
then you have to clean it up again. And then I always figure that, I mean, yes, you know how to play each of those drums and toys and instruments, but you always have to organize it too.
And
to get there, and that you really have to think through this piece. And how much time does this organization take, or do you get really fast after a while because you grab the piece really fast? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's a very individual thing. For me, it's both. I don't want to say it takes a lot of time, but I want to take my time. Of course, with experience, you see, okay, yeah, I placed this instrument here and this instrument there. But right now I'm working on a new piece by Peter Edwards, who's teaching in Singapore, for piano and percussion. The duo that I mentioned before still exists. And I saw he wrote for 12 different instruments, like drums, metal, wood, and stone instruments, free of choice. And when I saw the score for the first time, I thought, actually, in order to read this, because it's a lot of notes, in order to read this, I might just organize this as a clavier. Then it's much easier to learn. So I thought, and partly it was true, but when I started practicing the piece, I realized probably then it's too wide. So I placed the drums in front, and then the other instruments still look like it was like chromatically arranged. That was just a decision. At one point, you just have to take a decision and start practicing. And so far, it works well. Another piece also by Peter, he wrote for 25 Almglocken. Super fast, super virtuous. There's no way you can arrange this as you would do it on a marimba or so, simply because that's way too wide, especially in, you know, grabbing intervals and chords. So I had to find a solution for that. How do I arrange this? And as I said, I like to take my time simply because it will make playing much easier in the end.
And I guess sometimes it's trial and error that you
totally
try it or set, and then you're like, oh, I don't get it.
Totally. Or you play one section and it works super well, and then you go to the next section and realize, oh, maybe I should have the triangle on the right, not on the left. But I need it on the left in the other section. So probably the solution is getting a second triangle and things like that. Yeah.
Ah, okay. Yeah. And I mean, you're also teaching at Lübeck. You already mm-hmm. mentioned that percussion. And I think you do the new music ensemble as well.
Yeah, I do. My job here is to run the new music ensemble. So percussion, okay. I teach. So our structure works like this. People in their fifth semester have to choose a profile. That's what it's called. It's like a focus study area. And those who choose new music, they will end up with me. And there are naturally also percussionists in there. And so I will teach them for everything that is related to the profile / new music activities. So yeah, this is my job here.
Mm-hmm. Great. So if people are interested in working with you, apply.
Please come to Lübeck. Yeah.
Lübeck is very beautiful.
It is.
I like
indeed.
This city.
Indeed.
I mean, it's a little bit far away, but it's really cute.
It is far away and dark in winter, but very, very beautiful in spring,
really?
Summer, and autumn. Yeah.
Lots of water. I like that.
Yes, that's true.
And what I would like to know from you as well is, do you have any approach to time management? Are you a very structured person, or how do you organize yourself that you get all those things done you already mentioned today?
Yeah, I mean, you have to be organized in a way, otherwise you mess up things, right? I'm structured and I'm not structured. That really depends on what I do. I have these periods when it gets really tense and dense, then I have a schedule, like getting up at 6, start practicing at 7 until 9, first rehearsal 9:30, things like that, what everyone does. I had to learn to allocate a little bit more time. The older I grow and the more responsibility the job brings, that already started in Malaysia when I was teaching there, I had to allocate a bit more time in organizing things. Okay, you know, I need 1 hour, 1.5, 2 every day to write emails and so on. I think this is all the things that come with growing up in the end. But also I like a certain flexibility and spontaneous approach to things. Where I'm actually very structured is when I practice, because I and rehearse as well, because I don't appreciate I cannot appreciate music when there's not a very focused work. And for me, that happens when I'm very structured.
Okay. So that it doesn't mean necessarily the time framing, but what you do within this time.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So this morning, before we met, you know, I knew, okay, I have 2 hours and this is the section I need to work on. This is what I aim for. And then I think, okay, what do I have to do in order to get this done? Because we all know practice time is limited. So I really like to know after 2 hours, yes, I got this done and it's there. That's actually, it gives me a good feeling, to be honest.
Actually, something I think people are often surprised. I think the most practice time I had while I was studying.
Yeah, totally.
Of course, I'm in the job. I have to, but you get better with practicing because you, as you said, you know really what to focus on and how you get there. And so I guess you're more efficient. I mean, I don't think I was efficient when I was studying. I was just practicing a lot.
Yeah. Same with me. I think this is when you can afford 7 or 8 hours of practicing and not to worry about it. And but you might be right. Maybe not all these 7 or 8 hours are super efficient. Maybe you can just do this in 4 hours or 3.
And who or what has played the greatest role in shaping you and what inspires you?
This sounds like now from a thanking speech in an award show, but it's really true that it's, of course, it was my parents who supported me with, you know, with buying instruments, providing for music lessons. And, you know, especially when you are young, they need to drive you here and there to this concert, that concert, and so on. So for and foremost of all, but then, of course, my teachers. I was extremely lucky always to have teachers, starting with the already mentioned Norbert Scherer, who were always very into percussion as a whole. So not too much focused. I mean, sometimes you have that the first teacher, and this is what a lot of young kids want to do, play drum set. And then the teacher does drum set and that's it. Depending on what you want to study, there might be a more orchestral focus, which is, there's absolutely nothing wrong about this. It was just for me, much better to study somewhere where I got many different influences. That's all my teachers. Norbert Scherer, Michael Gärtner, Bernhard Wolf, Tajiro Miyazaki, Pascal Pons. So they were extremely important for me. And then when we look a little bit at this Southeast Asian context, there was at the beginning, Dieter Mack, who brought this ensemble to Manila where I was a part of. And through this experience and through all the years in between, we've become very close, because we share, a similar biography with our work in Southeast Asia still until today. And then it's these local musicians and friends in Southeast Asia, who made these 6 years I was in there extremely influential for me. It's mostly composers like Tazul Tajuddin, the head of composition when I started working at UITM in Malaysia. There was then the dean, Dr. Ramona, so many, many people, composers, who I worked with, Peter Edwards also. So you see, it's a bit difficult to mention just a few names, because I think in every stage in life, you meet a new group of people, and then, they all sort of have their equal stakes in what shaped me. But in terms of music, I think this is so a rough way. Yeah.
And what does success mean for you?
Oh, what does success mean for me? Success means to be very deeply happy with what you do. And this is not necessarily only for music, but also whatever I do in private. You know, I talked about this duo with piano and percussion. We had a hiatus, as they would say in the pop world, for about 12 years. And that had to do with different career paths. And then in 2022, we decided just to play together again. We were friends all the way, but we thought like, hey, let's get back and play music together. And we played a concert at the Saarländischer Rundfunk in 2022, which was a wonderful concert. And I think successful because it was a good concert, successful because it was nice to do this recording at the radio station, but more so success to be musically united again with not only just a good friend, but also with someone who I click musically very well with. So it's these kind of things that I feel this is success. So it's not about winning an award or a competition or so, which is always great and useful and super, but these are career steps. Success is something else for me.
And is there anything that drives you forward, or do you have any kind of vision?
Yeah, I have the vision, and this is also related to Southeast Asia. I want to present this music more and more in the European context, because I think there are so many strong composers, so many strong compositions from the region, not only just now, also pieces that are some decades old that are just not played very often here. I'm surely not the only one who plays music by composers in Southeast Asia, for sure. But yeah, this is a bit, this will be sure a very, very important part of my musical life forever, simply because I'm totally convinced of the music that is produced and performed in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, let's see what we can do about that.
Yes, sure.
Great. Actually, we are at the last question, and I would like to know from you, is there any tip you would like to give young starting artists?
Yeah. I think it is extremely important that we stay extremely open and flexible. That sounds a bit like you could say in general to everyone. But what I mean by that is that we have to have a look at our music world, at the current situation. I think we have already been, let's talk about Europe first, in a transformation already for a couple of years, where coming from the education and institutions, where we cannot be too, let me say, narrow-minded, because in a way that's what I mean. Even it sounds like a huge criticism, maybe it is, but what I mean by that is like you cannot go to a Musikhochschule anymore, music university, and say, I want to become an orchestra musician, period, and that's all I do. You can, you might be lucky, or you might be so good that it would work out for you, sure. But there are more and more competitors. We have seen in the last few years that some orchestras were put together. It's difficult to decide how the situation will be in the future, but it surely will be more and more difficult to get an orchestra seat. Thus, you need way more knowledge about other things as well, playing chamber music, playing solo. This is probably rather still normal for university syllabi. But then also to think, how can we organize projects? What can we do as performers in a creative way? How can we build our own concepts? How do we approach organizers for concerts and so on? This is already changing, and it will change even further. I have to say, I have no idea how this whole discussion and discourse with artificial intelligence will change. There are other experts for that, but that surely will have an influence as well. So that's why I think stay very open, do as much as you can. I think especially for young artists, they need the drive, and they need to. It is a lot of work, and they have to be willing to put this in. And then also, I talked about the situation in Europe. Now, maybe also looking a bit outside of Europe, also more and more will we be in touch with people of different cultural background. We have this already, but it might even more and more become would become an option for people to look for jobs outside of Europe, or at least outside of Germany. So you also need to strengthen your intercultural skills. I think this will be very, very important, is already, and will be even more so. So I would also tell every young artist, whatever opportunity you can grab for this, grab it, because it is definitely needed.
Well, thank you so much, Max. Thank you for taking this time, and I hope to meet you someday.
Hopefully, yeah. Thank you very much, Irene.
This was the interview from today. I hope that it inspired you. And please send me your emails, send me your feedback, because I love to interact with you. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I really, really hope that you liked it. And please tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. I thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.